So I want to share with you a little bit about two amazing practitioners that can teach us a lot, that can help us see our potential no matter how much we think we do or do not have. Let's see, these guys, let me get my, actually I'm better look at gallery. You can see me. You guys can do what you want. Okay. So, you know, because we often think that it's an odd idea, because these two beings that I'm going to talk about, Angulimala and Milarepa, who had difficult lives. And it's odd to think that we would look two beings on a certain level worse than us, ethically, arguably, at some point in our lives, and find solace in them and inspiration. So it's really fascinating. I mean, these two, Angulimala and Milarepa, are, in a certain sense, two of the most violent people in Buddhist literature. But they're precious. They're precious for us to help understand how our paths can be. And usually we turn, you know, towards beings we emulate, that there's some perfection we're turning towards, and we want to see if we can be like that. And that's a beautiful way to approach our teachings. But, you know, that can be like a big stretch, especially if you read a lot of Tibetan stuff. It's like, oh my God, they did this retreat and that retreat. And it's incredible. Some of these great lamas back in the 17th century, the incredible activities that they did. And it's like, how does that relate to my 21st century life? So it's hard to, sometimes it's like the accomplishment gap. Or even reading about Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Bua or someone like that in Southeast Asia, the level that they approach their lives, it's hard to know how to relate it. But this is, in a sense, why Angulimala and Milarepa have really inspired people, seekers, for centuries, just because their lives were challenging. And in a sense, they started off extremely low, you could say, compared to us. So we can take heart from that and think, oh, if they could awaken starting from there, maybe I can too. So in that way, it's really helpful. And in both cases, these individuals were, at certain points early in their lives, they were murderers. They were certifiably murderers. Each one of them killed multiple people. So, you know, right out of the blocks, that's difficult. But they achieved awakening. Angulimala, with direct guidance from the Buddha himself. And both of them, Angulimala and Milarepa, they show the power of intention and determination to overcome obstacles. And they also show the innate awakened nature of us underneath our stuff. And to be sure, there's also this basic truth of karma that needs to be dealt with. And both of these two created some difficult karma that they had to work through in different ways. But they did. They did. And they woke up. So I'm going to tell you the stories a little bit because they're pretty interesting. And then we can, a few thoughts, and then we can share whatever we want to share. And I'm going to read a little bit here and there from the suttas and things because it says it better than me. So Angulimala was a contemporary of the Buddha. He was a forest-dwelling brigand and murderer of such awesome power that he terrorized the entire region around Jetavana Monastery. And that's in what is now northern India, near where the Buddha grew up. And this idea of a forest brigand is not just sort of a metaphor, because to this day, there's places in Bihar, for instance, where they just say, don't go there. You know, there's, if you ever read, what's the book about the pilgrimage in India? Rude Awakening. Yeah, Rude Awakening, about Ajahn Suchitu doing pilgrimage on foot. And they got completely robbed in the forest in Bihar. Actually, I think I might have been there. I think it was the fall of 91 when I was actually in Bodh Gaya, that they ended up in Bodh Gaya, and all these world travelers gave them new sleeping bags and stuff, and they had a second chance. But nonetheless, happened to them. So it happens. If you ever go there, they say don't drive the 12 kilometers from Gaya to Bodh Gaya at night. You know, in an auto rickshaw, not a smart idea. So Angulimala's name reflected his grisly pastime, because the words anguli means fingers, and mala is a necklace. So he had a necklace of fingers, which he wore around his neck proudly. And so bloodthirsty was he, according to the sutta, which, by the way, is Majjhima Nikaya number 86, if you ever want to read it yourself. But he transformed the region. It says, brutal, bloody-handed, devoted to killing and slaying, showing no mercy to living beings. He turned villages into non-villages, towns into non-towns, settled countryside into unsettled countryside. So he was something else. And they hadn't been able to stop him. And the Buddha, this is where it gets so interesting, because the Buddha, he intuited some potential in Angulimala that was lost on everyone else. He was the baddest of the bad. So this is really helpful, because when we think of persons, you know, politically these days, it's really easy to bifurcate, and those other people, they're really bad. And certainly other sides of the aisle think the same thing about each other. So the Buddha intuited potential in him. And after alms round, the sutta said the Buddha set his lodgings in order, his hut at Jetavana, and then he set off carrying his robes and bowl. So it's really interesting that he'd already done alms around, so he was carrying his bowl with him like it was a symbol. He wouldn't normally do that, but it was like a symbol of his role as a monastic. It might have been to help communicate that he did that. I don't know why. It doesn't say, but it really struck me. That's interesting. Why would he do that except what he had in mind? And another really interesting part of this is his silence, because people were begging him not to go toward where Angulimala was. And it's really interesting in the suttas when the Buddha is silent, because he's often silent about things that are, he says in some places, like, the amount that he knows is so much vaster than the little amount he can say that can actually connect with people. And there's things that he won't respond to. You know, like what happens with Tathagata to a Buddha after they die, or how does karma work? He just is silent. So this is sort of one of those times, because the villagers, as far as they were concerned, it was suicide to walk into the forest where Angulimala was. I mean, whole groups of people armed had gone there and hadn't returned, much less this hapless monk with a bowl. So it was certain death. And they begged him not to. It says here, cowherds, shepherds, and farmers saw him going along the road to where Angulimala was staying, and on seeing him, said to him, don't go along that road, contemplative, for on that road is Angulimala, brutal, bloody-handed, devoted to killing and slaying, showing no mercy to living beings. Groups of 10, 20, 30, and 40 men have gone along that road, and even they have fallen into Angulimala's hands. But the Buddha was just silent, didn't respond, just kept walking. So he goes, and they don't go with him, because it's like, no way. So he goes, when Angulimala sees the Buddha coming toward him, this was like low-hanging fruit from his point of view, and he wanted to get the 1,000th. He already had 999 fingers. So he was going for the 1,000th finger. He says, oh, man. So he took up his sword, it says here, he took up his sword and shield, buckled on his bow and quiver, and set off after the Buddha. And the Buddha, in the suttas, he doesn't use psychic powers almost hardly ever. But here he does, and it's so interesting. It's one time where he does. Because, try as he might, Angulimala could not catch up to the Buddha. And you kind of picture the scene, we're in the forest, the Buddha's in full robes with the begging bowl, serenely walking down this path, and this mighty Angulimala is thundering behind him, trying to catch him, except he can't catch him. And this caught Angulimala's attention. He says, isn't it amazing? Isn't it astounding? In the past, I've chased and seized even a swift-running elephant, a swift-running horse, a swift-running chariot, a swift-running deer, but now, even though I'm running with all my might, I can't catch up with this contemplative walking at normal pace. So Angulimala stops, and he called out to the Blessed One, stop, contemplative, stop. But the Buddha, over his shoulder, says, I have stopped. Angulimala, you stop. And one of the things that is so amazing about the Buddha during his 40 years of teaching is that he speaks to people in ways they can understand. He uses all kinds of metaphors and parables, like completely, you know, talk to farmers about digging and planting, and then I'll talk to fire worshipers about fire, and he's always shifting the way he presents the Dharma. And in this moment, he got through to Angulimala. And another interesting thing is he often identifies people on the verge of awakening that there's no evidence that is the case. Like there's one place where there's a leper standing out on the edge of a whole group of people, and the Buddha saw that he was ready and kind of addressed him. So in this case, the Buddha saw something. Despite all of Angulimala's heinous deeds, there was some potential there. And he sees more potential in Angulimala than Angulimala sees in himself, which is something we can think about in terms of how we feel about ourselves, because we often don't feel like, who am I? Or what's my possibility? Or, man, am I a train wreck? But this guy was, he's got us out train wrecked. So the Buddha says, I have stopped, Angulimala, once and for all, having cast off violence toward all living beings. You, though, are unrestrained toward beings. That's how I've stopped, and you haven't. He just said that. And Angulimala gets it. It was like, wham, it just hit him in the heart. And he got it. And he's so stunned by this incredible person, the Buddha. And he says, at long last, a greatly revered great seer for my sake has come to the great forest. Having heard your verse in line with the Dhamma, I will go about having abandoned evil. So he just like does this incredible 180. And right there, he bows to the feet of the Buddha and requested going forth, which means he asked to become a monk. And right there, the Buddha granted his request, and he says, come, bhikkhu. So this is like the shortest ordination period I think I've encountered, definitely in terms of a 180, anywhere in the suttas. And maybe that's why he had extra robes. It doesn't say he gave Angulimala the extra robes he had with him, but they do go back to Jetavana Monastery, and Angulimala has robes somehow. So he may have brought them along and said, put on these robes. And he quickly blended in with the other monks. I'm not going to go through the whole story because there's all kinds of interesting things that happened. But I think what's striking here is, you know, Angulimala had an intensity about him. He was a really intense murderer. And he brings that same intensity to his practice now. You know, it's not like us. I mean, we're good. But, you know, we practice 30 minutes here and 30 minutes there, or an hour, and then we do other stuff. Angulimala, he just did it. He just went all in. And the sutta says, then Venerable Angulimala, dwelling alone, secluded, heedful, ardent, and resolute, in no long time reached and remained in the supreme goal of the holy life for which clansmen rightly go forth from home into homelessness, knowing and realizing it for himself in the here and now. He knew birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done. There is nothing further for the sake of this world. And thus, Venerable Angulimala became one of the arhats. So he just powered through. It's hard to know how long it took, but that's all he did was practice. And you can see that in the suttas. A lot of times, you know, people will go for alms rounds and then they sit for the days abiding. Like they sit straight through for 7 hours or something, or 8 hours. Then they talk at the end of the day. So he just did it. And I think there's something to learn there because, you know, even in the 21st century, you read about Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Buwa or Buddhadasa. Those guys, they just really applied themselves. I mean, they really did. And that was a distinguishing characteristic that insofar as it's accessible to us, to keep in mind how much it changes things. So Milarepa is Tibetan tradition. Kagyu in particular, but about 1500 years after this episode with Angulimala, in the mid 11th century, the great yogi Milarepa emerged after very difficult beginnings. And this story is different from Angulimala's, but it has some themes that are similar. And these are, in particular, that Milarepa killed many people, and that his hidden potential, nonetheless, was recognized by an awakened being, and that Milarepa demonstrated fierce determination to awaken despite the handicaps which he had because of having killed people. And his story, you know, it's very different. It's one of powerful family treachery and choices that, in some degree, arguably, he was forced into. In brief, he grew up in a wealthy Tibetan family. So he lived very nicely, and they had land and servants and yaks and a big house. But his father died of disease when Milarepa was 7. And the will gave the father's brother, Milarepa's uncle, control of the family fortunes until the son came of age. But it turned out that this brother and his wife were of ill intent, and they appropriated the wealth for themselves and forced Milarepa and his mother and sister to live as their servants. Milarepa writes, "Our food was food for dogs, our work for donkeys. Forced to toil without rest, our limbs became cracked and raw. With only poor food and clothing, we became pale and emaciated." And the mother, in particular, was really angry, embittered, basically. And she insisted that her son learn black magic to punish the relatives, and if he didn't, she'd commit suicide. So he was kind of boxed in. So he learned black magic. And during a family gathering of his uncle and extended family, he conjured up all these spells, and it brought earthquake and hail, and the house collapsed, and 35 people died. And he, got this retribution, but he just killed 35 people, and he was horrified. So he sought a teacher who'd find a way to reverse the karma he'd created. And he was turned away by several teachers, but finally Marpa, a master, could see the potential. But Marpa was interesting, Marpa the translator, because he had a very brusque approach, which was, in Milarepa's case, kind of what he needed. And at least outwardly, Milarepa's path was more difficult than Angulimala's, because whereas Angulimala got immediate teachings, became a bhikkhu instantly, and had a pretty relatively smooth track to awakening, Marpa set tasks for Milarepa that were excoriatingly difficult. In particular, Marpa told Milarepa to build a round stone tower on the corner of his property with his bare hands alone. So Milarepa did that. But then, when the round stone tower was nearly done, Marpa told him to tear it down. That was wrong. Build a half round stone tower. So Milarepa tore it down and built a half one. But then when that was complete, Marpa feigned anger and said, no, he'd never asked for such a thing. How wrong Milarepa was. What kind of fool is he? Tear that down. Build a triangular tower. So he had to tear it down and build a triangular tower. It was going on for years. And then Marpa comes and says, nope, that's a mistake. He needs a 9-story square tower, but he promised this would be the last tower. Because Milarepa is begging at this point, saying, come on, please, give me teachings. He's asking for teachings. And Marpa keeps saying, okay, build this tower and I'll give you teachings. And then he keeps tearing them down and asking for new towers. But as it happens, one of Marpa's students had rolled a big boulder, which got down into the square tower's foundation. So built it all the way up, and Marpa saw the stone. He said, no, you can't have a stone from one of my students in that tower. You got to tear it down and rebuild that tower. So he tore it down and rebuilt the tower. So finally, when Marpa gave Milarepa teach, he said, his great sins have been erased by the 8 great afflictions of his mind and by numerous small agonies. So this was really a compassionate action that Marpa had done, giving him these incredible tasks. And then he gave Milarepa instructions and supplies, and Milarepa meditated nonstop for 11 months in a cave called Tiger Nag. And Marpa said, to meditate for 11 months without the cushion getting cold is excellent. He never got up, meditated 11 months. So, you know, you can do whatever metaphorical stuff you did, but Milarepa was amazing. He has these songs of Milarepa's, his beautiful book of all these incredible songs that he created. And he continued with extreme practice, with tremendous hardship. His clothes became rags. He became emaciated. He turned green because all he ate was nettles. And hunters would encounter him and thought he was a ghost. But there was someone who wrote about his biography, which says, but within, Milarepa had a perfectly clear and unwavering resolve to realize a true nature of mind through meditation practice. That made him happy and content and gave him the strength to overcome all external obstacles. His serene confidence that realizing the true nature of mind was simply the only way to gain liberation from suffering won over all who had pitied and scorned him. So he just focused on the path in his own way. And I'm just going to read you, he has this extraordinary voice. I'm just going to read a couple of his songs of awakening, his whole book of them. He says, here at this place so high, at Red Rock Fortress of the Sky, here at this meeting place, which Dakinis of the Four Kinds grace, all you students gather here, please listen with attentive ear. This mountain retreat that's free of dogmatism and narrow mind is the guide that nurtures and sustains samadhi experiences. Is there anyone here who is able to keep this path and follow it through? The one who knows that the body itself is the monastery is happy. And then one other short one. He says, these cotton clothes I'm wearing, which are neither hot nor cold, this is the guide for travelers whose retreat is in the snows. Is there anyone here who is able to keep to this path and follow it through? The one who is not intimidated by heat and cold is happy to be able to lie down naked in the snow. The instructions that make it possible to connect up with transference. This is a guide for conquering all bardo fears you have. Is there anyone here who is able to keep to this path and follow it through? The one who makes no split between this life and the next is happy. To arrive at last in pure being's expanse is Imaho. So he was just this incredibly transcendental being, but he started for murdering 35 people. And it has this intensity. You know, in both these cases, there's this intensity. And so, you know, what do we do with this here in the 21st century? I mean, we're lay people, we're not monastics, and we have responsibilities and all that, so we probably can't wall ourselves in a cave for 11 months. But we can look to these beings and see if we can find that fire inside in our own way, the determination to shed attachments and fully walk the path. And, you know, in a way, the choice is vivid now. Climate change, war in Ukraine and around the world, that depending on samsaric phenomena for satisfaction is futile. We can't depend on that stuff. And dropping clinging and awakening is the only refuge. But a blessing we have, something we can take from these stories, is we don't have a backlog of bad conditioning, at least in this lifetime. Everyone in this circle's ethical people, so we haven't killed anybody. And so we don't have to overcome problems that we have created. So you could be happy about that. You all be happy about that from hearing these stories. Oh, cool. I don't have a handicap. And maybe we don't have an awakened teacher like Marpa or the Buddha, but we do have the teachings and we do have good ethics and the possibilities open. So you can really find this inspiring. And even in Gulimala, he didn't get off without working off some of his own karma, because even after he awakened, some villagers figured out who he was. Kind of hard to tell at first because he was wearing robes and you can't tell. But they figured out that was him, and they stoned him. And the sutta says, so venerable Angulimala, his head broken open and dripping with blood, his bowl broken and his outer robe ripped to shreds, went to the Blessed One. The Blessed One saw him coming from afar, and on seeing him, said to him, bear with it, Brahman, bear with it. The fruit of the kama that would have burned you in hell for many years, many hundreds of years, many thousands of years, you are now experiencing in the here and now. So he got off relatively light compared to burning in hell for thousands of years. But these stories really inform, you know, our journey on the path. It's really worth taking into your heart, seeing where it lands for you. I would say they give us hope in a sense. They give us hope. And I'll give you offer three takeaways that may land for you. I think the first is just, you know, there's another way of looking at the sense that there is no concrete I which is inherently reprehensible or incurable. There is no such thing. So no matter how much we may condemn someone else's actions, that's different from condemning the person. The person doing the actions is not evil. There's causes and conditions we don't understand. You know, bad choices they're making, maybe whatever, but they're not incurable. There is not a solid entity there which cannot change. Because look at these folks. So it really brings us, you know, here's a world, there's so much division, to really bring up compassion in our hearts toward the very people with whom we disagree the most. Because these two guys, they were the worst. How could they be worse? You know, just literally killing people with your hands. I mean, the persons that we dislike the most politically, whatever, they don't actually do that. So if he could be awakened, then who knows what else might be possible in this lifetime or a future lifetime. So it helps us see the infinite potential in others and in ourselves. And when we recognize how these damaged beings awaken, we can strengthen our sense of confidence in ourselves. What a gift. The second thing is the importance of spiritual urgency, samvega in Pali. And you can really see this with Milarepa. I mean, he had this not happened, I don't know. You know, he was born in good fortune. He's cruising in this really wealthy Tibetan family. Maybe he just would have been a merchant and made a lot of money and not awakened if this hadn't happened. But he gained spiritual urgency. Same thing with Angulimala in his own way. So sometimes when we realize with piercing clarity that things are unsatisfactory, that is the fire that makes us move ahead. And spiritual urgency is a big deal. And what Bruce was sharing, you know, we hope Bruce will continue. But all of us, you know, when we're born, that means we're going to die. And we don't have much time. Even y'all young people, you got a little more time than me, but not that much more. So, you know, we really have to go for it. So, you know, his only option was awakening, Milarepa. And that's really the only option for any of us. And building and rebuilding the towers, you know, it seems so impossible. Does practice ever just seem impossible to you? Oh, man, I just can't do this. It's not working, whatever. It's too hard. Just think about this guy building and rebuilding stone towers with his hand. This incredibly frustrating situation. And what we have to do seems a lot easier. It's helpful. And, you know, maybe we think that's mythology, but I know a couple who Nico and Devon. Yep. Nico and Devon, they live in Ashland. I mean, they're like 40 years old, 45, something like that. They're a couple. They met. It was the Northwest Dharma News, the last issue. They met. They were both in intensive retreat at two different retreat centers in Colorado. And for some reason, those two retreat centers briefly got together and they ended up having this conversation with each other about how neither one could never ever get married because they were so committed to practice. So they married each other and now so committed to practice. And they're on a year long retreat. And this last winter out in the mountains in Ashland, she was in a cabin. He was in a tent in the middle of winter covered with snow and pedal to metal. So, you know, people are doing stuff like that now, and we can do that in our own way, but just find that fire in ourselves. Just stretch our boundaries. You know, it's like whatever your boundary is, and stretch it a little bit and then stretch it a little bit. Just keep seeing where we can move it. And the third thing is that while karma is inescapable, rebalancing our negative karma is workable. We just got to apply ourselves, but it's workable. We can do it. It's possible. These beings did it. We didn't murder a bunch of people, so we don't have to build a bunch of towers. But it's workable. So we may think, God, I wonder who I was before. For whatever way you think about rebirth, I'll just leave it out there. Or even this lifetime, we did icky things, some of us. Who knows? I probably did. But it's workable, and we can heal. We can move it ahead. So just, you know, how we practice, the love we cultivate. Kama means action in Pali. So no matter what damage we might have done, we can take action and reverse that and be kind and help others and practice in love. So I'll end with some verses from Angulimala because they're really interesting. He says, talking about himself, kind of, and it's a little bit excerpt because it was longer, but who once was heedless, but later is not, brightens the world like the moon set free from a cloud. His evil done deed is replaced with skillfulness. He brightens the world like the moon set free from a cloud. Irrigators guide the water. Fletchers shape the arrow shaft. Carpenters shape the wood. The wise control themselves. Some tame with a blunt stick, with hooks and with whips. But without blunt or bladed weapons, I was tamed by the one who is such, reference to the Buddha. Doer of no harm is my name, but I used to be a doer of harm. Today I am true to my name, for I harm no one at all. A bandit I used to be, renowned as Angulimala. Swept along by a great flood, I went to the Buddha as refuge. Bloody-handed I used to be, renowned as Angulimala. See my going for refuge? Uprooted is craving, the guide to becoming. Having done the type of karma that would lead to many bad destinations, touched by the fruit of that karma, unindebted I eat my food. Don't give way to heedlessness or to intimacy with sensual delight. For a heedful person absorbed in jhana attains an abundant bliss. The three knowledges have been attained, the Buddha's bidding done. Let's sit for a moment.